as I said previously, I'm happy to be here on this occasion. Nice to see so many people taking an interest in meditation practice and in the teachings of the Buddha. Ajahn Brahm would have normally been here this evening, but he's away in Melbourne at the moment, attending a conference. Not quite sure what this conference is. It's something to do with Buddhism and Australia. Australian Buddhism, a discussion about Australian Buddhism. Probably the direction Australian Buddhism is going to take in the next 100 years, guided by Ajahn Brahm. Which is an interesting idea, that whatever direction it takes, whatever conclusions they come to, really there's only one direction it can go in. Whatever emphasis that is put on the teachings of Buddhism, really it all comes down to the same thing, really. Basically, the thrust of the teachers of the Buddha's teaching is generosity. Basically, dana, giving. You can say this is the cornerstone. This is the cornerstone of why the thing is in being in the first place. Really, what it all boils down to. If you think, you know, you might sum up, what is this Buddhism? You know, what is it all about? What was the basic teaching of the Buddha? And you might say, well, you know, the Four Noble Truths. You know, but in actual fact, that wasn't it. You know, the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths only on certain occasions. When he considered that a person was actually ready to receive the Four Noble Truths, this is called the teaching which is peculiar to the Buddhas. Buddha teaches the teaching of the Four Noble Truths only under very specific conditions, when he considers that a person really has opened up sufficiently to really understand the depth of the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. But what the Buddha did teach, generally and generously, was this teaching of dana. I mean, this is how Buddhism came into existence. That's why it actually stays in existence. It is this generosity, this giving, and this is a very important aspect. In fact, when the Buddha planned a means, a process, you can say, a structure, although there isn't details that the Buddha in his mind thought of such and such a structure. But in hindsight, we can see that the structure of the Sangha and the lay people is a very obvious result of a very natural law in existence, this cementing together of beings in a very positive way through coordination, cooperation, communication. And when the Buddha set up the Sangha, he set up the Sangha because he realized that this teaching of the Dharma is the law of existence. Basically, existence, you can say existence is involved with existence. You know, this is where we're at, you know, if we stop and think about it. we exist, you know. There is this existence, you know, all our problems come from the fact that we exist whether we like it or not, you know, but how we exist, you know, really does make a big difference. Since we exist whether we like it or not, it would be nice to do whatever we can to make this existence as palatable, as tenable as possible. So the Buddha realized that this teaching, it was humanity, not only humanity, but the whole of the cosmos was caught up in a problem in which they needed a means of coming to terms with. So he could see right at the root of the possibility of liberation was right there in the seed of generosity. And this goes, every creature does have this basic ability to communicate with other creatures of its own type. You know, this connection, this giving and connecting with other creatures. Basically, right at the root of that is a certain amount of communication, positive communication, and it's through cultivating that and extending that, making much of it, that the Buddha could see that this was the way for beings to liberation. So when you look at me here, when you look at us here, we are Buddhist monks. Now you might consider that we are something separate. The Buddha just structured the sangha, the sangha of monks, to live as something separate. But really, that isn't the case at all. The structure that the Buddha organized was what we call now the fourfold sangha. That is, that the monks and the nuns, laymen and laywomen, and the Buddha did this deliberately when he constructed the sangha at the same time as the monastic sangha, at the same time as the lay sangha. They weren't separate. Like when you see us sitting here, we don't exist in our own right separate from the lay sangha. You know, we are here because we are, you know, we are supported by the sangha. We are in existence simply because we are fed, taken care of by the sangha. You know, we're not allowed to take care of ourselves. We have to be wet nursed by others. You know, and the Buddha did this deliberately because at the time of the Buddha, there were lots of you could say summoners, there were mendicants, holy men, ascetics, and generally they tended to live by themselves. They tended to eke out an existence. There was a whole range of ways of eking out an existence, but they were liberating themselves in one way or another. And the Buddha could see that if he simply started a sangha of monks, then quite likely some would get liberated. Some would go off into the Himalayas, find their own little cave, have their own little cabbage patch, or eat nettles or something, or pick fruit, and they could quite possibly get liberated by themselves, and that would be it. That would be the end of it. You know, they would disappear once they'd gone, once they were dead, and no one would know any different. And the Buddha could see that this, apart from anything else, was a great waste. One or two people may benefit from this, but since he realized that the condition of the world is humanity. Humanity is suffering. And therefore, he set up a plan where the whole of humanity could actually receive the benefits of this practice and have a chance of being liberated. So in the way he did this was that he set up the monk sangha so that they would be the people that would do the actual practice, that would keep the teachings in existence, would keep the teachings in a continual existence by that being their occupation, that being their sole reason for being, or simply dedicating the whole of their life, the whole of their existence, the whole of their consciousness to perfecting the teaching, keeping the teaching in existence. But they needed the lay people. So the little trick here that the Buddha inserted was that the monks cannot take care of themselves. They had to have the lay people, and this was a rule. You know, the rule: a monk cannot feed himself. He has to be fed by lay people. That means that the lay people, they come to the monasteries, they come to the monks, and they receive the teaching. The teaching is a reciprocal thing. It's in the world. It's given to the world. The lay people keep the monks in existence. They come to the monastery, they feed the monks, and then the monks, if you like, feed the lay people with the truth of the teachings. And eventually what happens is, of course, those lay people, then their children, they receive the teachings as well. And of course, the sangha, the monastics, they come from the lay people. But it's there, it's always available. The system is there in the society. The possibility of receiving the teachings, of being liberated. So in fact, you've got almost like a continual, reciprocal, ongoing process of the teachings being in the world and having as great distribution and application as possible. And it's just the longer I'm in the sangha, the longer I practice, the more I become to realize and appreciate just what an incredible visionary the Buddha was. If we go back and we look at the time of the Buddha, and we see the whole range of spiritual teachers that were around at that time, and with all the systems they had set up, you can in comparison, you can see that the Buddha, why the Buddha has the title the Buddha, the awakened one, you know. None of the other teachers, you know, could be called Buddhas. They will have all sorts of various titles, but the Buddha, you know, really deserved the term Buddha, and that became more and more apparent, and more and more of the people and the population at the time realized that the Buddha's teachings was absolutely unique and incredible. And of course, that continues today. The more, my interest when I first got involved in Buddhism years ago, it's only now that I realise that I just scraping the surface. I just really did not appreciate the sort of the gravity, the sheer gravity of this super knowledge, this cosmic being, you can say, that the Buddha was. And he could see right from the start that it was this generosity, this encouraging people to practice this generosity, to cultivate this generosity. And he realized that this is what releases people. This cultivating of generosity, it goes completely contrary to you could say the basic animal nature of beings, of human beings. Our basic nature basically is to grasp, and bring to us, to eat, to feed, and to just have the impression generally that that which that which I can get here, that which I can stock up on, the more I can get of the world of possessions, material gains, the more secure I am, the richer I am, by the more of the world that I can stock up, the richer I will be. And this in fact was the thing the Buddha could see. This was the thing that was keeping people grounded to the earth, that's keeping people sort of attached and clinging to the world, this whole relationship to the world as a possession, you know, material gains or even power. You know, people just, from the mental point of view, just power, and of course sensuality. The basic craving in existence is the thing that keeps people attached to the world and keeps them. The curious thing is, it keeps them separate from the world because it builds up the sense of them. It builds up a solid sense of ego structure, and that in itself tends to be a very defensive thing. It actually separates beings, and therefore people with a very solid ego structure, whatever their relationship with other beings is, it's always what they can get from other beings. It's always something in the world I want. I won't be happy until there's something in the world that I have. So whatever it is in the world, they look at it with eyes of greed and lust and wanting. Even if it's a relationship with a partner, they will see that partner as something that they will consume, or something to be consumed. And they'll treat this partner as just something that they can get something from. And as long as that partner supplies that getting from, then they're happy. But if something happens with that partner in somewhere or other, blocks that or obstructs it or stops this giving that the other one wants, then there's something will go wrong with that relationship, and that person will think, you know, I'm being done here. This is not why I got married. This is not suitable for me. You know, this is not, you know, not what I, this was not the contract. This is not what I signed for. You know, this person is not behaving in a way which is suitable for my well-being in some way. In other words, it isn't a relationship of giving. You know, it isn't a relationship where the person says, the value of this relationship is what I can give to this other person. It is very important to me that this other person is a happy being and contented and has love in the world. And I consider that is my responsibility, to see that this person has love and happiness, and that's what I can do. I can give that. That my concern in this relationship is the quality of the relationship, is the loving exchange, the communication with it. Whatever I need to sacrifice, then that is fine, because the result is it's love that is coming from the other person. When you want to get from the other person something for yourself, regardless of the other person, in other words, you're taking something from them, then that relationship cannot last long. It cannot be a healthy relationship. Whatever tenderness there was there, sooner or later, will just dry up. So this generosity, this giving, and as in the Sangha, this dana, is very, very important, very, very important. And the Buddha goes into this in quite a lot of detail. He places so much importance on generosity that he says it is the saving, you know, it is the saving grace. It is the means by which a being will actually become liberated. If a person just practices generosity all their life, then they are going towards liberation. Just that generosity, they're getting closer and closer to liberation. So the Buddha just encourages that we give all the time. Just give. Because you're releasing the thing in yourself that grips and clings, and that actually keeps you as a very sort of tight, solid little thing that depends on some sort of objectivity to give you some sense of purpose, some sense of identity. A being is released by being open, by opening up away from this tiny, little, meagre, mean, wretched ego self. Now, in one of the suttas, the Buddha gives some quite amazing illustrations. He says that what I say is giving anything at any level is of great value. So the incredible thing about there is a magic about giving, about generosity, and this incredible magic is it's a karmic thing. This is something that we could maybe we, at first hearing it we need to take it on faith, because it is the Buddha says it is a karmic thing. So this is something we cannot with the human eye. We cannot readily see this happening instantly, but the Buddha, being a cosmic being, you know, he had the divine eye. He could see the transparent nature of the cosmos. He could see the structure of existence. Why it is in existence? What holds it together? What influences it? And the Buddha said, if only people could see what I can see, if only people knew what I know about giving, about generosity, then if people knew what I knew, they would never eat a meal without sharing it. They would just constantly be giving all the time, because this is their greatest beneficiary. And he said, the reason is, karmically, when you give something, it is such a wholesome act. It is such a wholesome act for you to actually give and release this sort of tightness inside you, which wants to cling. This reversing of this craving and clutching and clinging. The benefits of this are far greater. I mean, if you place a value on that gift, whatever you consider the value of that gift was, in whatever way you might consider the value, even if it's in monetary terms or even if it's in the happiness it would give you, the Buddha says that the returns, the karmic returns, eventually the benefits you get from that giving are far, far greater than the original value of the gift. And he said this, you know, this is a curious thing, and he went into it in detail. And he said, in fact, it actually goes up, and it has a graduated path. The more wholesome the person, the greater the person, the more spiritually developed the person, the greater the person that you give to, then there is the greater returns. Now you might feel there's something a bit suspicious about this. You know, the Buddha, you know, just about the greatest person that you could give a gift to if you wanted a really great return. But the Buddha wasn't shy about saying this, you know, simply because we can take that then that this must be the case. It must be the case. So, you know, if you were to give to a Buddha, you know, then the returns, the karmic returns, would be absolutely inestimable, absolutely incredible. But the Buddha said, you don't even need to give to a Buddha. You know, if you give to anybody or anything with a heart of generosity, then just that much is an incredible return on your investment. And he said, you know, like just an ordinary everyday person, a human being, just giving a gift to an ordinary human being, there is an incredible return on that. And so the higher the being, of course, the greater return. But that isn't really necessary. We can just simply give to ordinary friends. And the Buddha said that even the lowest returns you can get, like is giving to an animal. Is it even giving to an animal with a heart of generosity? Is it even emptying the remains of your food out? So with the mind state that may the animals feed on this food, may the beasts of the field, the birds in the air get sustenance from this food. And the Buddha said, even giving to an animal, you can expect a hundredfold, a return of a hundredfold, even giving to an animal. The Buddha is saying, in other words, the Buddha is saying, giving, generosity, is this potent. It is an incredible boon that we do have. It is there. It is a law. It is a law of the universe. This generosity is the positive aspect of the universe. All the good and positiveness in the universe. This is the system. You're simply tuning in to this benefit that is actually there, which leads to the wholesomeness, which leads to spiritual uplifting, leads to your spiritual progress. So you may feel that that's okay for the Sangha to say that. You know, the Sangha lives off this generosity, and isn't it in their benefit that they preach such things about giving to monks? You know, keeping monks in business, keeping monks fed. Well, you know, I can't deny that. You know, I don't want to starve any more than anyone else. You know, but you know, in a way, you know, it's an act of faith. You could say it's an act of faith. Nowadays, of course, when people get support in Buddhist countries, when people become monastics in Buddhist countries, generally the system is well established, and they can feel reasonably secure that they're going to get a meal. You can't always be sure, but you can feel reasonably sure. But of course, that actually comes from the Buddha. Like people in Thailand and Burma, Laos, Sri Lanka, these people that are fed today out of the generosity of lay people that give food. Now this is still, like you can say, a ripple, an echo of the Buddha's original generosity. He set up that system with incredible wisdom, and you can say that is the proof of the pudding in itself. It's still going, and so you say, well, you can imagine in the beginning, when monks left home, it really was a more serious business in the days of the Buddha. The Buddha said that, you know, when you become a monk in under the Buddha, then what the system you're getting involved in is, you know, you don't expect to get well fed. You know, you're not here to get well fed. This isn't the point of the Sangha. The bare minimum. I mean, you're here. The reason that you become a monk or a nun is for spiritual liberation, to get beyond the world, and that is worth sacrificing the home life for. So you'd get young. You get young men and young women would give up their lives, give up the home life, you know, and give up the security. And then they would go into the jungles, which were very uncertain, dangerous places. Many places where you didn't know whether you were going to get fed or not. You know, in those early days, they must have gone hungry a lot of the time. You know, and the Buddha said that you're not necessarily going to get a roof over your head. If you join this Sangha, the most you can actually expect is is to live at the foot of a tree. Don't expect any more than that. Now, if you do get more than that, that's fine. If you get a house to live in, I mean, the Buddha said, you know, even if you get a mansion to live in, you know, that's fine. But don't expect that. You know, the most you can expect is either a heap of straw to sit on, or the root of a tree, or even out in the open, or if you're lucky in a rainy season, you can live in a cave. And medicine, in those days, medicine was cow's urine. So the medicine you can expect, don't expect anything more than just basic cow's urine. You know, obviously, it must have worked wonders in those days if you knew how to apply it. But anyway, the thing is that, so the Buddha preaching that it was beneficial to give to the Sangha, I mean, he wasn't saying that. He wasn't saying that because he was trying to get the lay people to give him food so he could sit around all day, sit around doing nothing, watching his navel. You know, that man left the palace. He left the whole kingdom behind him. He would have been the king. So we can consider, we can take for granted there was something more in it than that. It's quite interesting that even these days, I mean, this insight and generosity of the Buddha still happening to this very day. For me, the proof of this is that I've been practicing now as a monk for 19 years, and I've never missed a meal. You know, it's amazing. You know, I've never overtly gone out of my way to try, you know, to feed myself. But it's just incredible magic that it's always been there. You know, in all the most unlikely, incredible situations I've been in at times, you know, food has always simply just been there. And I put this down to the incredible barometer, you know, we call it, or the incredible spiritual development of the Buddha. So what I'm saying is basically, you know, as Buddhists, make the most of it. You do have this knowledge. Since you have this knowledge, since you have this ability, you know, take advantage of this to the hilt. Be generous. I don't mean give to the Sangha. I mean, just give anywhere. Give to your favorite charity. Just get in the habit of giving. You know, exercise this faculty. Make the most of it. You know, you don't have to be Buddhist. You know, anybody here that's not Buddhist, that's okay. You're still on the same system. You know, you've still got the ability to be generous. Exercise that. You know, anything you can give away. You know, if anybody needs anything and you're there and you can give it away, then just spontaneously give it away. Don't worry about the consequences. You know, these days people are worried about making money, amassing wealth, amassing more money. You know, how do you know when you've got enough? You know, there's this basic insecurity-mindedness we have. We're just constantly trying to make more money. You know, the fear, you know, the struggle to keep the wolf from the door, and you know. Sometimes we might even lose sight of the wolf, but just the fear that who knows when the wolf's going to turn up. So people just get caught in the system of making money, you know, making more. I mean, like all the incredible business people you hear about, the millions that people make and get lost in. I was reading in the paper some time back that Walt Disney is... The managing director of Walt Disney, this is a couple of years back now, managing director of Walt Disney, he made a profit after tax and after everything else that can be taken out of his money, he made a profit in 1 year of $581 million. Hang on, I'll say that again. After tax, 1 year's earnings was a profit of $581 million. 1 year, right? Now, It also mentioned at the end of the article that he had a quadruple bypass, had a plastic heart. So the question is, you know, where's the real value? I mean, I don't own anything. Well, I do actually. This robe's mine. This was definitely, you know, I don't even have $1 million. You know, I don't know if anyone believes me. But I do have a heart that functions good enough, and I wouldn't swap it for a plastic one if they gave me $581 million. But that poor man had no choice. And if you had asked him, what do you want, a proper heart or your $851 million, he'd have probably had a job making up his mind. You know, once you got that money, it's very difficult to let go. We were talking earlier that there's a man named Bill Gates. Bill Gates, another millionaire. Now, recently, just spontaneously, for some reason or other, he decided to give half his fortune to charity. It's just interesting. He just decided, you know, probably came to the conclusion, do I really need this? What good is it to me? You know, and there's a lot of suffering out there. So he gave half his, I don't know what his fortune was, but he gave half his fortune to charity. Then a curious thing, a short time later, his stocks doubled in value. Now, I'm not saying there's any connection. I'm just saying it's an interesting coincidence. So basically, you know, whatever direction Australian Buddhism is going in, whether it goes in the right direction, it's up to you. And it can go in a very simple direction. Just make the most of this ability you have just to be generous. Because Westerners have great difficulty with this. It's a very strange thing. You know, in the West, we have great difficulty with generosity. That's not that we're not generous. We do have generous hearts, but we can't do it spontaneously. Now, it's very noticeable when you get involved with Eastern countries, Buddhist countries, you'll notice that their culture all revolves around generosity. Even as children, they're brought up with that. Like when I was in the little village, in Ajahn Chah's monastery in the Isan, in northeast of Thailand, every day we would go out on alms round, right? And we would go out on alms round in the early hours of the morning, and the people there, they would cook up this rice. They'd cook up the sticky rice, khao niao, and they would give this to the monks, and they would specially do this. They would specially get up early and boil up this sticky rice, and they would give it to the monks. So what this meant was, they started off the day, every day of their lives, they started off the day with an act of generosity. You know, that's how that was the consciousness, the sentiment. Now, that was the standard, that was the procedure for the day. That's the foot you got out of bed with. No, the day proceeded from that. You know, and if any one of those people, you know, were late or missed giving that rice in the morning to the monks, they'd be very upset. Yeah? Sometimes you'd be walking along the road and you hear, what's that? And there's some little lady right in the road behind you. She might be about 85, but she'd be tearing along. What's that? Got a little basket of. She'd got up late, and she wouldn't, you know, she wouldn't, she couldn't live the rest of the day if she didn't give us this. But then she'd come up, oh, thank goodness! You know, then she'd stop, and then she'd give us our little bits of sticky rice. Yeah, but that is very important to them. They can see that you know, in their villages, their whole villages are, and that giving. That's what the village is all about. That development of generosity, that showing of generosity, that whole attitude of a human being, their value being around generosity. You know, you wouldn't be mean. You couldn't live in one of those Thai villages and be a mean person. You might as well pack up your bags and leave, because your life wouldn't be worth living. So, you know, literally acts of generosity indicated, shown all the time, whenever possible. You know, that was just so much a part of their culture. And the interesting thing is we've lost this. I'm assuming that we may have had it at some time or other, but we've certainly lost it more the more we get into the industrial corporate age. And so now, you know, in the West it tends to sort of conglomerated to smaller and smaller sort of little sort of packages. We ritualize it, make ceremonies out of it, you know, like we save it for Christmas. You know, Christmas is a time then when we can practice this, you know, then maybe it's releasing a bit of a guilt, you know. Of course, we do appreciate. We appreciate receiving things, don't we? You know, but then it's birthdays. Birthdays, you get a birthday card and a present. But you have to wait, don't you? Once a year. You know? Or then Christmas. I mean, it's a big deal, Christmas, your birthday, isn't it? So nice. Isn't it nice when people give you presents? Has anybody ever noticed that? You know, on your birthday, when people give you presents, how that feels. It's a beautiful feeling, isn't it? But equally, have you noticed when you give a present, when you see someone's face, you see the happiness? Now, you notice this with kids, don't you? You know, we know we have kids, so we buy them presents, and it makes them happy, and that makes us happy. But of course, after a while, it dies out, and we think, well, we don't have to do that anymore. But or people can be generous to their kids always, but then it might be just confined to their kids, you know. But it's their way of releasing. See, that generosity needs to be released. It's in there. It's pent up. You know, it's actually a great giant generosity inside us, you know, and we are keeping it pent up and constricted. It does need its release. So when we have these occasions of giving, it's because it makes us feel nice, because there's something, this generosity in us needs to be released. So it is nice, but at the same time that's countered by the greed, you know, the greed and the grasping and the craving, which, you know, prevents it full expression. And so it's always a battle. It's always a battle. And so we tend to, you know, almost ashamedly, you know, we have to have these rituals so we can be generous. And we need Christmas. But it's as if we do it outside of Christmas or birthdays or wedding gifts, there's almost, you know, it doesn't feel right. You know, we have to have, it has to be ritualized in this very sort of controlled way. I mean, if you met a person walk down the street and just sort of giving gifts to everybody or giving things away, you think, no, how did he get out? Watch him, you know. He's not the full quid. You know, keep an eye on him. Well, basically, you think if he just met you and he suddenly gave you something of reasonable value, you think, you know, is he selling insurance? Why is he being so friendly? You know, just friendship. You know, not necessarily monetary gifts, but just putting yourselves out, you know, just being friendly. All those times when you don't say hello, you just say hello. All those smiles that you avoid giving, you know. I mean, when you know, in the workplace, wherever, you know, there were people that, you know, there were close people, people we get on very well, you know, friends, people we mix with easily because they're friends, then we smile, we say hello, but, you know, some people it's a bit awkward around. Some people we don't get on so well with. And then we tend to increase that because then we tend to avoid those people. Well, not consciously, but we're less likely to notice them in a room. We notice the people, the attractive people that attract us in some way. People we get on well with, people that are friendly to us. When people are friendly to us, we respond to that. And the other people tend to sink into the background, even to the extent of not even being noticed. And then to the extent that you don't notice someone, then they don't notice you. You know, then you can get quite a stony sort of relationship with someone that you may have been working with for years and just barely on nodding acquaintances, and there's an awkwardness develops whenever you get when you communicate with these people. Yeah, but the truth is that, you know, really, if you actually made an effort to cultivate a relationship with those people, you know, you might find that really, you know, they are people that you have a great deal in common with, you know, a really deep rapport. And on a lower level, a deeper level inside you, you might need their counsel. You know, they might address something in you which really needs to be opened up. Now, so make an effort. Just notice in regular places you get involved with, the people that you normally, you don't have anything to do with, you know. you know, you don't even acknowledge, or you deliberately avoid. You know? Especially people have upset us, you know, that's it, I'm never going to talk to him again. You know, once he's upset me, that's it, he's done for life. I'm not going to put myself out to be friendly to him or her. Well, she looked at me on that occasion, no way, not going to risk getting another incident like that. Isn't it? You know, if people upset us, then we're so touchy, aren't we, basically? Ego. Whenever you're touchy, you can always know that this is ego. This is ego's defensive mechanism. It blocks off that which it doesn't like, and it lets in that which it likes, and it feeds on that. And really, it's a negative thing. Open yourself to all those situations that you avoid. So even if it takes a bit of effort, a bit of time to start actually giving presents that are something that might actually cost you something in a material way, just the hello, and the smile where you normally otherwise wouldn't do. You do it gradually with people that you don't normally smile at. I mean, if you suddenly smile at someone you don't normally smile at, you go, what's up with her? She's got a bit funny today. But be a bit discreet about it with people that you've got a stony silence with. Just in little ways, show concern. But always show concern. Always show concern for people, and never miss the opportunity to help someone. It's not actually costing you anything. The thing it costs you is that loosening up, because that's what you don't want to do. It's a bad habit of not relating to people. We like to keep in our own little shells. It's hard work, isn't it? It's hard work actually having to make friends. It's okay when there's attractive, a person that's easy to communicate with, you don't have to work hard. But otherwise, as we know, we're strangers. When strangers come into a room, we're introduced to strangers, then there's that awkwardness that we don't know. You can't just start talking about any conversation because you don't know this person. You don't know where they're at, what their personality is like, what they're interested in. You wouldn't just start talking to them. They might suddenly think how do you know you're not going to say something that's going to sound really stupid to them, or something like this. But the amazing thing is, you go to Thailand, Sri Lanka, you don't know people stop you on the street. Hello, someone said, where are you? And suddenly you engage in a conversation. It's absolutely amazing. You go to Sri Lanka, So walk in the marketplace, anywhere people just come up to you and start talking to you. They don't know you from Adam, and yet completely relaxed, and they're not concerned what you're thinking about them or whether they're saying the right thing. They want to be friendly. They know you're a human being, so they know that you've got human potential, and a human being is naturally a friendly person if allowed to be that, and that's all they relate to. In the West, we've lost that, particularly in England, I mean, you can only appreciate as an English person. You can only appreciate this when you get out, get somewhere human, get somewhere normal where people respond to people like human beings. The most terrifying people to me are English people. Who are they? This is the question. You wouldn't stop and talk to them in the street. You'd more likely be arrested. You wouldn't even stop and talk to them in a pub. You go in a pub and you sit there at the end of the bar and you sip your pint and don't know anyone in this pub. You might be checking everyone out. But if someone come up to you and said, oh, hello, are you coming after? You say, no. What do you want? But I mean, it's so noticeable. I mean, when I first started travelling in Asia and then I got back to England, I got into awkward situations. I'd go in pubs and start talking to people. What's up with him? Who is he? I suddenly realised that English people don't do that. Their space. Their space is so important. You do not contravene that space. And if you want to come into it, you come into it in a very, very gentle way. And more likely through a third person. It takes a third person to get into that. You don't realise what a burden, what hard work it is being an English person. You're this contracted little thing. Contracted little thing. I remember there's this saying by, what's his name? There's the English Elizabethan who made half the sayings in the English language. No. No one knows him? Oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, God, he's, my brain's going again. Anyway, he said that one day he went to Scotland. He went to Scotland, and he got into conversation with Scottish people there, and he made this bold statement. He said, "The grandest sight." He said, "Let's face it. The grandest sight to a Scotsman's eyes is the road to England." Very cheeky thing to say, you know. And he really believed it at the time. Well, you know, sometimes I feel to myself, you know, the greatest sight to an Englishman's eyes is the road out of England. Now, I'm saying this because I'm taking it for granted there are no English people here. I don't see why there should be any English people in Perth, the other side of the world. So, if there are, you know, I say this because I'm an English person and I know it's the way I feel. But I'm not knocking English people generally because I don't want them to knock me. Anyway, so the interesting thing with this generosity is that it actually works, but you have to prove it. You know, the opportunity is there. Very simple, just go out and do it. You know, just make this effort and just feel, you know, feel generous, because you've got it inside you. You are a generous being. And, you know, as I say, I've never gone without a meal. I mean, it's interesting, in England we used to, you know, the English aren't into giving alms food, you know. They're not used to monks on alms round, you know. But we used to deliberately, a bit cheekily, go out into, you know, into these little country towns, you know. And it used to fascinate me. We used to go out into these little country towns and sort of stand on a corner, you know, stand on a street corner with our alms bowl, you know. And people would walk past and look at you, oh my God. Hare Krishna's, oh, there we are. But after a while, you know, you get these sort of motherly types come up, you know. Hello, love, what are you doing here? So, oh, we're Buddhist monks and we are on alms round. Oh. So then you explain to them, and they say, oh, really? You don't eat unless someone gives you food. Oh my God! So they'd run off to the supermarket and they'd come out with, come out something that would fill your bowl up. Say, oh, I'm so pleased! I found out. I'd hate to think you'd go without food for the day. And this was amazing. And this would happen. And you know, sometimes, you know, there'd be like 12 o'clock. We can't eat beyond 12 o'clock. We can't eat beyond 12 o'clock. And what we used to do is, we'd go in one of these little towns, and they would get food, and then. We still had to eat before it was 12, so maybe 11:30, or even a bit later. Then we'd get enough food and we'd run round the corner to a little park somewhere, sit on a park bench, and we'd eat our grapes and bananas and donuts and whatever we're putting in our bowl. And it was interesting that the time would go, you know, the time would be standing there, or we'd be walking up and down, we'd be standing there, and we'd be looking at the time, and saying, nothing's happened today, nothing's happened today. I don't think it's going to happen, you know. Is it, you know, getting later and later, you know, 11:15, nothing yet. It's 11:15, you know, 11:30. It's only half. We should actually be eating by now. I know we should be eating, but we don't have any food. Well, it's 11:30. It's 12 o'clock. We can't eat as well, you know. Okay, patience is a virtue. I mean, at the time, then suddenly, you know, suddenly there'd be about 20 minutes to go. And suddenly, you get people from everywhere would just suddenly appear. Oh, wow, I've got you some bananas. Because my dear, oh, thanks. Quick, right now, quick, round the corner. Run into the park and just have time to finish the meal. And the joke is, you know, it would get so tight, but it got to the point where I'd say to myself, this is comical. I'm not going to worry. I don't care if I don't eat. But this is just comical, the way this happens. And literally, the times we'd spend, you know, on these street corners, with nothing in the bowls, and the last moment, it was suddenly, you know, even one person would suddenly just come with enough, you know, for the meal. Got it. Every day. And I know you might think that I might be fibbing a bit on occasion, but every time, something turned up. I mean, I remember one day we were in this town, and It's coming. The rain was coming over. It's getting darker, darker. The clouds were getting thick, and we were standing there. And then, right at the last minute, we got this food. Right now, where are we going to go to eat? You know, nowhere to eat. So we ran around the corner, and there was this church. It was a church. So shall we go in the church? Then the church was locked. They were doing some sort of refurbishing in the church. The church was locked. So we can't go in the church. It's going to start raining. Well, normally we would sit on that bench over there. And so, well, what are we going to do? It started raining. The rain started coming down. And so there was this corner of the wall, the way the church was sort of built with a sort of buttress. And there was this corner of the wall. We said, well, look, the rain isn't touching this point. Right. No. At least, you know, let's see now. Let's just get in here before, you know, maybe we can make it here. So we jumped in this little corner. And this was the only spot that wasn't being touched by the rain. And the clouds opened up and the rain started coming in. And it was creeping in and it was getting closer and closer. And then we're pulling our robes in. It's getting closer. But we're still eating. And in the end, it was 12 o'clock and we finished eating. And we'd huddled up into about 2 square foot of this corner of the church. So without actually getting wet, it was amazing. And we managed to finish the meal without getting wet. And we finished it in comfort, of course, with a little bit of entertainment thrown in. Well, it's getting late now, so 1 minute to go. So just as a summing up, that since we do have this opportunity, since we are human beings, and human beings are basically loving beings that do have the seed in them for total spiritual release through love and generosity. You know, let's just make the most of that. You know, never waste an opportunity to make the most of your generosity, to exercise your generosity, feel like a generous being. I mean, if you've got anything you don't need, you know, just give it away. And, I mean, there's no point in being a Buddhist if you're going to waste it, in other words. No point in having Australian Buddhists just to be closet Buddhists or Buddhists by name. No, it's not for the sake of just, you know, just being a Buddhist. It's for your benefit to use. This is a facility. You know, the Buddha wouldn't have wasted his time if it wasn't for your benefit. Yeah? So this is more just like a physician saying to the patients, you know, heal yourself. You can do it. The opportunity is there. Make the most of it. Right. That's it. It's all over. The time has beaten us. Can you come back next week?